Well, welcome everyone to this week's episode of It's Easy Son, your life's lessons on your journey to your promise. I want to first start out this broadcast today by saying we have yet another dynamic guest. This guest is someone who I always have a fun time with because he's both a Morehouse and a Howard grad. So I don't know how that works, but he'll explain that for us today. But Mr. Dave Moody is with us today, and he is one of the people that I've come to know and appreciate since my time coming to Atlanta. And he has been a source of inspiration and comfort as you're trying to understand things at Morehouse College, but in life in general. A very down-to-earth individual, and you'll get a sense of that today. A very successful businessman, a man that is well-known here in the Atlanta region and across the country for the work that he has done in construction and construction management. And I'm super excited that he took some time out of his busy schedule to spend some time with little old me. Once again, like all every week prior to this one, you're in store for a treat as Mr. Moody will walk us through his life experiences from his birth and his childhood, his family structure, and what that meant for him going through high school into college and now where he is as a very, very successful businessman. For those of us that follow him on social media, every morning it's a blessing to see his words of encouragement, his photos, his inspiration, and the way he shares to try to inspire others to greatness. Ladies and gentlemen, you're in for a treat on today. And with no further ado, I welcome to our podcast this week, none other than Mr. David Moody. Mr. Moody, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Hey. Thank you so much for having me, and it's an honor to be here.
All right. So I started this podcast with an idea of trying to replicate what was done with my first book. And as I went through the list of folks that I would definitely want young people and parents of young people who are reaching out to me and sending me words of encouragement to hear from is you. And in today's broadcast, what we would like to do, as I've done with all my guests before, is to just have a conversation that goes back and forth, but it almost seems one-sided because I don't speak as much. But as you are sharing and answering some of the questions I might put forward, our hope is that you will share with our audience some of your life lessons, words of wisdom, encouragement, and nuggets of wisdom, so to speak, to help us to continue to navigate, especially in these challenging times. So as we get started, just an open-ended question. Can you share with us a little bit about who is Dave Moody and your background and what grounds Dave Moody?
Sure. First of all, I think what you're doing is great. I think it's very helpful that you're sharing people's stories to help inspire and motivate others to see that regardless of what they've been through, they can still have an incredible life and hopefully giving hope to people. So anyway, I grew up in Chicago. I was born there. And then at 14, moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm 64 years old, so I was born and raised during the 60s. I was born in 1956, so I was a kid and a teenager in the 60s, and it was quite interesting times. I grew up in a complete black, basically segregated area in Chicago, and then I moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where my dad became a professor and then eventually vice provost. So I went from an all-black environment to an all-white environment. And after I finished high school, I was headed to a few other places, I thought, for school, for architecture school. But Morehouse offered me a football scholarship. I came down to Morehouse. Football coach had a football player take me over to Spelman at lunchtime. And I signed my letter of intent right then at Spelman's campus. True story. I never saw our practice field, equipment, or anything. I just said, oh, my goodness, this is beautiful, 1974, and I said, this is where I want to be. I came to Morehouse. I finished in 4 years somehow, and I had to take and a lot of – you couldn't even probably do this today, but I took 24 hours each of my senior year. I took 24 and 24 hours and made the honor roll for the first time. Both semesters my senior year so I could graduate on time. And it's amazing what you can do when you have to. because my dad sent me a note. Again, this is 1978. This was before, the fall of 1977. My dad wrote me a letter back then. This is before internet, email, and cell phones, and long distance calls were too expensive. So we wrote letters, and my dad sent me a card. And he said, "Son, I promised you Ford. Love, Daddy." So I knew what that meant. I said, "Son, if you don't finish in 4 years, you on your own." So I decided to get serious. That summer of 1977, I was a modern bus driver. They used to hire college students to relieve the vacation of bus drivers. It was an incredible experience. I loved it. But anyway, I went on to finish Morehouse in 78. And then I went to Howard University and got my professional degree in architecture. I started my career in architecture in 1981. I started with Bechtel Power Corporation, which is one of the largest privately owned engineering and construction companies in the world. I was in the nuclear power division. And back then, this was before personal computers, where we actually had to draw every day. Wow. And a field assignment came up. They needed an architect to go to the construction site of a nuclear power plant. I took that assignment and fell in love with construction. And I decided then I could just be an average architect, but I could probably be a really good builder. And from there, I went into construction, and then I moved to Atlanta in 1983. I got married in 1982. And when my wife and I moved to Atlanta in 1983, and I went to work for a small company. I left Bechtel, and my wife left her really good job, University of Michigan. I told her, I got a plan. We're going to go work at this small company, and I'm growing this small company and all those kind of things. And the next thing I know, 2 months after I got here, that company went bankrupt.
Wow.
So I left a good job. My wife left a good job. And then I spent the next 4 years working for small companies. And then finally in 1987, my wife and I decided to go on in business for ourselves. We were broke, didn't have anything to lose. And then we incorporated C.D. Moody Construction in 1988. And we borrowed $4,000 from a bank. Somehow they gave it to us. And, kind of, as they say, the rest is history.
The rest is history.
And so I've had my own business now for, 32 years. And I'm just, I still pinch myself because I don't believe I'm doing what I'm doing because I just didn't think, I would actually be doing what I'm doing because I had never really met any people of color who ran businesses, especially construction companies. So I had a lot of trial and error and learning in business.
So, Trustee Moody, you just laid out a path for us, but is there something, because whenever I follow you on social media and I see when you post stories about your mom and your dad and what they meant to you, in terms of your family structure, what was it like growing up in the Moody household?
Okay. It was, I grew up with two parents that were educators, but both my parents came from poor backgrounds. My grandfather, my dad's father, he came to America in 1901 and 17 from Belize. Then it was called British Honduras.
Right.
And so he was 17 at that time. When he came, he worked his way over on a banana boat. He knew no one here, and he ended up in New Orleans. And the reason he came to America was because he was only allowed to go to, as far as he could go, sixth grade. He could only go to sixth grade.
Wow.
And he wanted to get educated. So what I also found very interesting about his story, though, that has always inspired me, was that he knew he was coming to segregation. He knew he was coming to Jim Crow. He knew that he would be a second-class citizen, but he wanted an education that bad.
Wow.
And he came to America at 17. They put him in sixth grade at 17, and he went on and finished college and he became a gene supervisor, which is he was like a supervisor for the black school systems in Baton Rouge. It was really, really nice. And, he married my grandmother from Woodville, Mississippi. They had 8 children. They grew up in a shotgun house. All 8 children went on and got advanced degrees. My grandfather and grandparents never owned a car. I don't think they got electricity to maybe the 40s, maybe. Wow. Or indoor plumbing to the 40s. But whenever I would visit them, my grandmother lived till I was 13, and my grandfather, I believe, was 15 or 16. But my grandfather taught me the importance of hard work, but he also taught me about love. And I always tell this story and how family is first. My grandmother had passed away, and I had went down to visit my grandfather and my aunt who lived with him, my dad's sister. And I happened to be in the house where all of them were born, and they still live there. And my grandfather came in from his garden, and he had these flowers. And I was kind of sitting in the kitchen watching him go into the bedroom. And I heard him talking, but nobody was in the room. And I heard him go, "Mrs. Moody, these flowers are for you." Now, my grandmother had passed away and had been gone for about a year. But, man, that was the most powerful thing I ever saw or heard.
Wow.
And I think that's why I treat my wife the way I do. We've been happily married for 38 years, and I would never do anything to violate her trust or love. And when he did that, that just was the most powerful thing I ever seen about love. For him to still, that he would bring flowers in and put them on their dresser in their bed. And I always, as I look back now, it's amazing the things we do that will impact our children or people we come in contact with that is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And so it's very important that we are aware of what we do around our children and or any children we're in who are in our care or might be at our homes, because they're really paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, she grew up in a family of 7. There was never a man in the house. They grew up in Southside Chicago. My grandmother, my mother's mother, they came from Social Circle, Georgia. They were sharecroppers. And in 1937, while she was pregnant with my mom, they left with the Great Migration to the north, where they thought life would be better. In reality, it was no better. It just didn't have the sign saying colored only or whatever, but they still couldn't go in certain neighborhoods. So anyway, my mother, though, was kind of like a genius. She finished high school right before her 16th birthday. She went to college at 16. My dad is 5 years older than my mom, but she was ahead of school. My dad was a junior and she was a freshman, and they met. And after my dad graduated, they got married. He was an officer in the service. He was the first black officer to lead integrated troops in Panama in 1955.
Wow.
But when he got out to service, and he was an army officer and a college educated with a degree, the only job he could get in Chicago at the time was shoveling horse manure at a lab, because he actually had wanted to be a doctor. But both my parents were teachers and eventually got jobs teaching. And then my dad got his master's and got his PhD. He became one of the first black superintendents in the country in 1968. And in fact, he did his dissertation on black superintendents. And in 1970, my dad was 36. When I look back, he was 36 when he was the superintendent of schools. That's pretty impressive.
That is impressive.
Back.
Wow. Looking
and,
back.
It was a small school district. And then he decided and moved up to University of Michigan. And that's where we moved to. And actually, it was an awesome experience for me. And they stayed there until they retired. I lost both parents last year, 67 days apart. And that was a bit of a struggle to lose them both that fast. And my dad's passing was unexpected. But, you know, God gives us the strength to always get through things. But it, it was a tough time. Mm-hmm. But my parents, the house was, you know, we always, even though we might have been struggling at times in Chicago when they were trying to make ends meet, I was always happy. Then I had two younger brothers, 5 and 6 years younger than me. So, I mean, the house was always, it was a good house. It was a good family, love. We didn't want for anything, even though we didn't have a lot, but we never, you know, wanted for anything, never missed a meal. And that's why I'm very cautious about when I say, you know, things were tough and we struggled. That's at one level. It's totally different for people who don't know where they're going to eat or sleep. Now, that's real struggle.
Yes.
We, you know, we just would, I would say we had discomfort.
Right, right.
But there's
right.
a difference so to me, and I never take that lightly.
Yeah. So, Mr. Moody, as I listen to you share about your family, there's a lot of pride there, a lot of love. I can hear it coming through the airwaves. In terms of today, if we look at families today, especially in our community, is it the same or is it different? Is there that connectivity where, you know, we can learn from our grandparents and we can sit on our grandparents' knees and there's this oral tradition of passing things down? Do you think that we have lost some of that in our current dispensation in time and the challenges that you see not only in our community but all that's happening today?
I don't think we've lost it as much as we don't make people, how do I say this? I think the media and different things make people feel that the black family is not solid today. And I just don't think that's true. The black family is very solid.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I kind of got a core friends. We're in our 60s, you know, and all of us are just family people. I mean, yes, there are some folks that, you know, things break up or become step parents and those kind of things. But I think what we've gotten away from, that is okay to love and say you love, and it's okay to realize the power of love. I mean, and probably later on in this discussion, I'll talk about how my faith and love got me through the darkest period of my life in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've made it almost like you almost shouldn't have feelings and you shouldn't be compassionate or have empathy or feel love or cry. And those are all things that are natural to be human and to be healthy.
Right.
So I still think the black family is very strong. Right. I just think the media has made it look like it's not.
Right. And for what it's worth, I agree with you 100%. It's all about perception versus reality and the circles in which you move. Now, high school, you football, sports, and you made it to the house. You know, Spelman kind of was the hook, I guess, based on what you just said. But Morehouse College.
Oh, it was the hook.
It was the hook. Yes, I could see why.
Yeah,
I could
Spelman
see why.
Was the hook.
Spelman was the hook. But Morehouse, your time there, your experiences there, what Morehouse meant to you, and where do you see Morehouse today?
You know, I think that's a great question because you got to think about something. When I came in 1974 to Morehouse, that was before a lot of the white major universities were taking all the black kids to play ball and letting them in, especially in the South. And even in the North, there still was a minimum number, but the South especially. I mean, when I came to Morehouse, Georgia Tech didn't even have a black basketball player.
Wow.
Alabama probably maybe had a handful of football, black football players. It's 1974. So the reason I tell that story is that the AU Center at that time was just booming. We had Morris Brown probably had at least 4,000 students. You had Clark College then, and then you had Atlanta University. You had Spelman. You had Morehouse. You had ITC all in the same area. So we had about 12,000 of the brightest, the best, the sharpest dressed, the coolest, whatever, best athlete in the AU Center. I mean, so you got to think about it. I mean, it was just, it was phenomenal. And the other thing is, okay, I played football with Jose Williams' son, so I got to meet Jose Williams, John Lewis, Hank Aaron, Daddy King, Andy Young, who I'm still very close to. I mean, Joe, I mean, you name it, all the civil rights legends came through Morehouse. I mean, they were still coming around. And what I really got from Morehouse, I was with some of the brightest folks. You know, I was an athlete fraternity boy. I had a good time in college. Okay. My grades could have been better. They got better my senior year, but I had a good time. But my point being, Morehouse, the AU Center in Morehouse, it just instilled in you, you could do whatever you wanted. I mean, I felt, I just felt good. I never felt insecure. I never felt, it's kind of like Dr. King's letter to Birmingham jail. When I was on the AU Center, I didn't feel like I had to tiptoe around as a black man because I could be proud to be black. I was around a bunch of other sharp black folks who were starting, you know, and think about it, in the 70s, you know, the civil rights movement had just kind of kicked through. We had our first black mayor, Maynard Jackson. So more and more opportunities in corporate America were coming available and politics. So Atlanta was like, and it still is to me, the one of the greatest cities to live in for opportunities for people of color. Mm-hmm. And it was just phenomenal. It just fed me. And then I go to Howard. It's another beacon of just incredible, you know, stories and people and meeting people. So here I am at AU Center at Morehouse. Then I go to Howard. I mean, I had the best of both worlds. And so I just came out of both of those places just ready to tackle the world.
So HBCUs today definitely are going to see a rebirth because of what is happening in our nation, I believe, wholeheartedly. In your mind, where do you see them fitting in now in this, I call it a renaissance, so to speak, in African-American awareness or people of color in general, their awareness and the power that they have in unity? Do you see it the same way, and how the HBCUs can still play a role in that, in preparing our young men and women for the future, especially this kind of dynamic that's now playing out, even though we thought we were way past this from the 50s, 60s, and so on?
Actually, I, you know, back when I was there and before, you almost didn't have a choice. You know, your choices were slim because there was only so many slots that were open to black kids and white colleges. So the black colleges had a different kind of role. I think today it's even more important. And the reason I say that, for a lot of black kids today, so often they're always in the minority in school or in their neighborhoods or whatever. And there is nothing better than a black college. And for 4 years, you get to be around people who look like you. You're in the majority. You're in a comfort place. But more importantly, they want to see you succeed, and you're not just a number. Mm. You're not just a number. And I really tell kids who are excelling in academics in high school, you know, you can go to some of the big majority schools, but you're just going to be a number there. When a top rated students or athletes come to a black college, man, you're put to the head of the class. You're a superstar, the president of the college and stuff. You're the person that they have. You're in that group of students that when these executives come to speak and different stuff, you're the people out front that they show off. And I just think the opportunities for black kids at a black college are just so key. But I also think there's an exposure opportunity that you can't get at a majority school that you get at a HBCU. They can just change your life to knowing you can do whatever it is you want to do. And you don't have to tiptoe around wondering if people are looking at you funny because you're black or want to touch your hair, you know, those kind of things. So, and you, it's
that's so it's true.
Just, It's just peaceful. You just get to be at peace, you know, and you don't have to be on edge constantly. If it's more than five black kids on a campus at a majority school, are y'all upset about something, blah, blah, blah. You know, on a black campus, it ain't no big deal.
Right.
I mean, you just together.
You're just part of the family. So right. Trustee Moody,
people really want to see you make it. Go ahead.
So everyone knows you now as a very successful businessman in the nation. One of the largest minority-owned construction firms in the country. You have built or been a part of building some of the most iconic structures here in Atlanta and certain other cities. So coming out of Morehouse, then Howard, and you mentioned at the start of the interview, Bechtel and those other places. But as you think about it, did you have a set path that said, I'm going to do A, B, C, D, E, or did you meander a little bit, or did things happen for you in ways that you didn't expect, but you were just prepared in order to capitalize on them?
Well, I would answer it this way. I always knew I wanted to be in architecture. I didn't know I was going to be in construction. So I changed when I realized my real strength is construction. And I always tell people, be careful not knowing the difference between your passion and what you're really good at doing. My passion was architecture, but I'm really good at understanding the building process and being a builder than I would be an architect. So that's the first thing. The second thing, you have to be willing, like I did from architects to construction. It's not that you quit something, but you got to know when to change directions. So I never was so rigid in my career path that I didn't allow myself to see opportunities. I took risks. I mean, I left Bechtel as a newlywed to move to Atlanta, and 2 months later after that, that company went bankrupt. I was out of a job. I mean, so actually what I thought was my worst day became my best day, because I might not have never went into business 4 years later if that hadn't happened. So, and my faith has played so much of a role in my life. And as I get older, I'm still focused on learning to truly trust God, my faith, and realize I'm not in control. All I can do is my best. And after that, it's going to happen. And I got to be willing to flow. I do rafting. I did a rafting trip down the Grand Canyon in 2017, where I slept 7 nights without a tent. And I just slept on a cot every night. And then I hiked out 7.5 miles, 4,200 feet elevation change.
Wow.
And the reason I tell that story is because in rafting, there's something that they teach you. If you fall off the raft, you put your feet, cross your feet, put them in front of you, you know, put your feet in front of you and cross your arms and let the current, let the rapids take you until either the raft catches up to you or you swim with the current to shore. You never fight against the current because you're not going to beat it. Well, I've learned that's how you really got to live life. When you're hitting a storm, don't try and fight against the storm. Just hunker down, let it kind of take you where it's going to take you to safety, you know.
Wow.
But you got to be prepared. But if you're fighting always against the current, you know, you won't make it a lot of times. So that's how I've kind of learned to look at life. And the other thing about that trip to the Grand Canyon, for 7 days and seven nights, I was totally disconnected from the internet, TV, cell phone, nothing worked down there. And I realized how much negative noise we hear every day.
Wow.
And we got to do a better job of disconnecting for at least an hour or two a week. You know, just turn everything off and just go here. Just go hear what's around you. You know, find a park or whatever, but just learn to turn all that noise off. We just hear so much negative noise, whether it's from people, TV, phone call, news, something. If you just pay attention how much negative things you hear, it's not healthy. And that trip changed my life in 2017 to be more aware of that.
So you just said something that struck me as I was listening. One of the things I really admire about you is your openness and your candor And, you know, what you see in Dave Moody is what you get. But you just mentioned your faith in God. And in business today, there's this tension between someone's faith, which, you know, is spiritually in nature, and then the business side where we're practical about it. But how do the two intersect for you, and how does that guide you in your dealings with these mega structures that you're putting up or being part of a group to put up? Is your faith something that just washes over everything you do, or is it compartmentalized?
Now, my faith is everything. I try to make it everything I do. I can lose my temper occasionally and use some words I shouldn't use, so I have to watch that. But I don't leave my house in the morning, but I have a prayer kneeler. And I go and pray every morning, and I have a upper room that I read every day, and I try and meditate. You know, and all of it takes probably 10 minutes or less. But I try to always center myself and just kind of get myself together. But I'm one of those folks that I want my actions to speak about my faith. I'm not one who's going to walk around hitting you with a Bible or telling you I'm a Christian, because I'm a firm believer. If I have to tell you that I'm a Christian or whatever religion you're in, then I'm not living the kind of life. If I got to tell you, then you don't see it in me. Mm-hmm. So one of my prayers is that may God and Jesus, because I'm a Christian, but I'm also a believer that other religions are great too, you know. So mm-hmm. I'm not one that says that my faith is the only way to go. That's just what I have chosen. Mm-hmm. But I'm a firm believer that our actions should speak for who we are, and that's what I focus more on than telling people. And I just try to stay grounded in that. I try and stay aware. I'm focused on, you know, I always tell folks, I'm always stand on the side of truth, because as long as you tell the truth, you don't have to remember the last lie you told. So in business, life, everything, uh-huh. you know, it's going to be. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, in business or life in general, people tend to take that kindness for weakness, and then you have to, you know, be firm at times. So it's a tender line to work at times, but mm-hmm. to walk, but it's, I never trade my faith. And I'll tell you another story when my faith and love really got me through my toughest time to me in my life.
I think we should get there, because I've heard you tell this story and a couple of times, and I have been blown away by it, because 9 times out of 10, when people see someone that's successful, they see the end product, but they never saw the process and how you got to the end product. And quite honestly, when I heard that, I said, Mr. Moody has to be one of the guests to share. And I'm so pleased that you're willing to share this story, because I think it's extremely powerful. So I would just say, just go right ahead, Mr. Moody.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm very public with this, but it took me a lot of years. It was 2012 before I ever went public with this. But I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and I had planned on, you know, dying with my secret. I thought I had buried it, and I thought everything was fine. And 1991, the fall of 1991, I just won. I was the first Black to win the Small Business Person of the Year from the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. I mean, I just went to the White House and gotten a national award with other minority-owned businesses. So 1991, you know, I'm riding high, you know, winning these awards. And then early 1992, my wife found out someone close to her had been sexually abused by someone that we actually knew. And all of a sudden, I just blurted it out that it happened to me. And I had never planned on saying that. And you know, I thought everything was okay. And then within a couple of months, I started having panic attacks, and we couldn't figure out why, because I didn't think something that happened 26 years, 27 years ago, I just didn't even think those two were connected. And then finally I had a complete emotional breakdown. I actually had a nervous breakdown out of town with uncontrollable muscle tremors and spasms and crying and just broken. And I had to drive home 5 hours from the event. but we still hadn't figured out what was going on. I thought I had a brain tumor or something going on, but I couldn't tell anyone other than my wife and a couple of people because, you know, nobody talked about, you know, those kind of things. And also people would have thought I was weak or whatever. So I had to suffer in silence. And that's one of the reasons I speak up today, because I don't want anybody to suffer in silence from a trauma, be ashamed or anything. But I remember being at my lowest point, and I remember looking in the mirror and going, God, I don't know what's going on, but I will never give up my faith and trust in you. And my wife's love, she had just only been out of nursing school a couple of years. And during the same time in Michigan, her mother's dying of a brain tumor. So, I mean, it's just, I mean, we're just in disarray. We got two young kids. And, but her love, God's faith, finding a therapist who put two and two together and getting therapy. And, it was a brutal couple of years because I had to do it in secret, you know, but we won our team, our joint venture won the Olympic Stadium contract. And that was the job that actually took me to another level. And so even while I'm struggling and going through all these things, the business kept going. We actually got stronger and better. And that's how I know God has a plan for me. And that's why eventually some opportunities came in 2012. I started a website called MoodySpeaks.com for anyone who's dealt with the trauma of childhood sexual abuse. It's a resource place and positive stories and it hope and things to inspire people who might be suffering in silence and give them hope and know that healing is possible and incredible lives are possible regardless of our past. And I just have, and I wrote a book called Fighting Through the Fear, My Journey of Healing from Childhood Sexual Abuse. And it's a business book too. It's all my whole journey. But I just realized my website's been read in over 120 countries, and I speak all around the country on turning trauma into triumph. And, you know, you hear other people say that they were sexually abused or some other kind of trauma that affected them, but they don't very the impact. And I know how lost I felt because there was no one around that I could talk to who had been on that journey. So I thought I was either weak or, you know, something was wrong with me because I couldn't just seem to flip a switch to say, okay, I'm okay. And so that's why I speak up, because what I went through is actually normal. When I say normal, that's what most people go through with a trauma that's finally dealt with. Right. And so I just speak up to show folks that I still have an incredible life, a great family. It was a horrible thing that I went through, but it's just, you know, nobody should have to suffer in silence and nobody should ever feel alone on this journey. So that's really how I really got so secure, knowing that there is a greater and higher being that takes care of us. And I'm sure there are people who say, well, if there was a higher being, why would they let that happen to you as a kid? Well, you know, those kind of things do happen, but it's the story that I get to tell much later that helps so many other people. So I always find something good or some kind of spin to make it better and keep living.
Yeah. I watched a podcast, an interview that you did, and they were talking about this particular, you were talking about this incident and the people that got released just from you talking about it, because folks walk around with things pent up, and that being pent up actually diminishes their capacity to work or be at the level they should. And that's something that I know a lot of young people and people who have gone through that have appreciated, just based on the comments that I was seeing, I guess, live. But with your successes, you have had the ability now to, you've been chair or president of the Rotary in Atlanta, which is pretty impressive. And you've had some other positions in the city and around, and elsewhere around the country. But as people look up to you today, as a businessman, as an icon, as a leader, what would you say to young folks today, or young professionals, I should say, because young folks can run the gamut? we're in this COVID-19 era, and businesses are, unemployment is high, and folks don't know where things are going to go. In the South, where we are, we're seeing the spikes, and there's not a lot of consistency. So there's a lot of ambiguity and fear out there. But you have been through, and you just shared with us what you have been through. What words of encouragement or wisdom could you share with folks today in the context of what we're seeing in our nation?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked me this question, because I've looked at this pandemic in a couple of different ways. It's a horrible thing, but it also has had its benefits of making us all kind of slow down and just look around. And I realized how much I was always moving, just because I felt like I always had to be moving and I don't have to. I look at how much better the air quality is. My garden this year is unbelievable. I mean, I haven't had this kind of harvest in quite some time. And I wear my mask out in public constantly. I avoid crowds. You know, we're back working best we can, wearing a mask. The biggest thing I can say, I've been through a lot of different things. I've been through Great Recession. I've been through the recessions. I've dealt with, you know, a complete breakdown. The only thing I can say is like that rafting analogy I gave is, you know, be smart, prepare, because there are going to be a lot of opportunities that will come from this, but be smart in your health, take care of yourself. But this is the first time since the Spanish flu, 1918, where the whole world's economy is affected by an invisible enemy. And, you know, this is different than most recessions. So, and we need to get out and just prepare, but also use this time wisely. And my biggest, I guess, concern is for parents of children in school, and they got to stay home and try and work, and the kids got to stay home now for school, which I think makes sense, because, you know, you can't have an epidemic start running through the schools, and then you really got a bigger problem. So, I mean, it's a bad situation, but it's a situation that has a lot of upside eventually, but we've got to weather this storm. And every day I pray for the whole world in this pandemic, and also for the demonstrations in dealing with police brutality and racism. I mean, so we got a lot on the plate, but we'll get through it.
It is a lot on the plate, and it challenges all of us, because you can't find your way through this storm by feeling for it. You almost have to just sit still. I remember a quote that says, you know, sometimes we chase moments, and sometimes moments come find us. But you said something just now, Mr. Moody, that is very interesting. You basically were saying just ride out the storm. But when you look at what's happening with our young people, especially young professionals who just graduated, there are no jobs on the market. In terms of what you just said about opportunities will come, when you went through and you saw the shift in your circumstances that forced you, I guess force is a good word, that forced you to start your business. When you see the opportunities, are you talking about them being entrepreneurial minded or just being prepared book smart wise? What does that preparation look like?
I think the biggest thing is don't get locked into this is the direction I want to go, but you know, walk toward that direction, but keep your eyes open for other opportunities, whether it's entrepreneurship, opportunities in the business, going back to school. I mean, listen, I can't, you know, I'm sure the young folks who are finishing school and like, man, where the job's going to be. I mean, I remember that in the 80s. I remember in the 90s. I've seen it many times, and it is scary, but it's going to work out. I mean, look, I came down here in 1983. I left great jobs to come, my wife and I, to come work for a company that I thought was going to, you know, take me to another level. And 2 months later, that company was bankrupt and I didn't have a job and I was married. So you know, I had to go out and find little jobs and didn't make as much as I was making. And we went from doing well to struggling. But one thing I've learned, and I always say this to people, we all would be knocked to our knees one time or two in our life, but you will get up, and we are so much stronger than we realize. It's amazing what we can do and how we can push through things when we have to.
Amen.
And you can't let imaginary fear, stop you. And I know, you know, I'm talking now as a 64-year-old man. So I hope your listeners will know I'm talking because I've been through so much. But I understand when you're in your 20s or teens or early 30s and that stuff's kind of hitting you for the first time, yeah, it freaks you out. I get it. I get it 100%. You know, now I'm at that stage. I'm just happy I get up in the morning. I mean, I got buddies with cancer. Seriously. You know, I got three good friends who are dealing with cancer. One just called me before our interview saying his, he has prostate cancer and his PSA is still slightly going up. So now he's got to get radiation. And I mean, so it's so many things that go on in life. And once you kind of get to a certain age, man, you're just happy you still here and can get up and walk and your mind is still good. So I tell young people also, when you're single and no children, or man, you are so free. It might be tough times and you might be struggling, but that's one of the freest times of your life. Now that I look back, when the only person I was responsible for was just me, that means you can go take jobs or, you know. And I also tell them, man, go see the world, you know, go take a job somewhere, even if it's not much money. But just get those experiences. I mean, I look back, I came along when, hey, you finished college and you just went to school. I mean, there's a part of me back in the day, I wish I would have went to the Peace Corps or something where I could have went overseas and seen and did some things. But, you know, my family was like, hey, you need to get out, you know, go get a job. And I look back and I tell young people that if you can afford to take care of yourself and make minimal amount of money and don't need a lot, man, get out there and take some chances with seeing things, trying different jobs. And those who have graduated and can't find jobs right now, you know, find something else that you would just like to try and do and hopefully make enough money to live, you know, get a roommate, but you just adapt and get ready.
That is so awesome. Thank you for that. Now, Mr. Moody, we have about 10 minutes left, and I have always been intrigued. Moodyville. What is Moodyville? Tell us about Moodyville.
Well, it's a name. Moodyville is where we live. I've named it Moodyville. We got 4.5 acres with a fishing pond, and then it's like 40 acres of forest and farm and wetlands behind us. So it's like a 45 acre compound, and all the wildlife come to our pond. We got bass fish, we got crappie in there, we got the deer that come over there, we got coyotes, I got a couple of hawks, I got blue herrings, I got egrets, I got a greenback herring, we got a couple of foxes that live back there in my garden. So you might see any kind of creature back there, and I've gotten pictures of all of them. And I just named it Moodyville, and I just enjoy being out there watching the wildlife, and I leave them alone, they leave me alone, and I take pictures of them. And I got my garden at a 6-foot fence so they can't get to my garden, but it's just fun to watch nature in action. I mean it's amazing.
Is your blue, you have a blue heron,
and that's
you
posted
a, that's Moodyville, and you posted a picture of a blue heron. Is it a blue heron that comes by every now and then, and you snap a picture? It seems to me then, and the reason why I asked you about Moodyville, because you talked about farming and, you know, your crop and your harvest and all those things, but with the time that we have left, your connection with nature, is that something that also grounds you in terms of your connection with people? You're connected to the earth and you replenish yourself, I guess, And that kind of enlivens your spirit around how you just live your life. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I was a Boy Scout. I was a Cub Scout and Boy Scout, and I fell in love with camping and the outdoors, and it's just so peaceful and relaxing, and there's nothing better than to me, nature is one of the most healing forces that exist for us. The peace and quiet, and watching the animals, going on a hiking trail. I've been up to Springer Mountain and places where the Appalachian Trail starts. I've hiked in Colorado and different places, and it's just phenomenal, the sights and scenes. But it's just very refreshing. In fact, I'm at a point now where I could see myself living in the woods in a cabin. Of course, it'd be a nice cabin with all the utilities, but I could see myself just spending more and more time out in nature and just watching, just watching nature and letting it heal you. And I have a lot of respect for farmers, people who work in nature and grow crops and the animals, and people who also are just free, who live in nature. There's something about that. And the older you get, the less you realize how much you really need to be happy. And if you can learn that younger in life, boy, you'll be so much happier, because there's so little that you really need to be happy. We can, we all get caught up in material things, the show that you've arrived or you got this, you got that. And you'll go through a stage where, I went through it too. When I finished college and started working, I wanted to have certain things just to say I had it. And pretty quick, you start realizing, and that's not that big of a deal, and I always use Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, as my classic example. One of the richest men in the world. He couldn't buy one more day on this earth. Wow. And I'm willing to bet he would have probably given a lot of that away for more time. Mm-hmm. So that kind of always keeps me grounded, that I don't care how wealthy you are, you can't buy one more day on this earth. Mm. So I've learned to kind of realize it doesn't take a lot to be happy.
Yeah. Trustee Moody, we have about 2 minutes left, 2 to 3 minutes left. I do this with all of my guests, and I definitely would want to give you an opportunity as well. The reason we started this podcast is to inspire young people who can hear the stories of folks who are not necessarily athletes or actors or individuals in the entertainment industry or major, whatever it might be, when they're always in the public eye. So they could see that there are pathways to success, but it really depends on how you define your success. In closing, what is on your heart that you could share with young people or people listening to this broadcast about just to uplift or to inspire them to be more than they could be?
So I think the one thing I tell people all the time, especially young people, you got to dream big, because I exceeded my dreams. I my dream really was just to have a good job, and be able to take care of my family. I never dreamed I'd be doing what I'm doing. And because I didn't dream big, my business actually was limited, because I exceeded my dreams so quick that I was comfortable and said, okay, I don't need to be any bigger. And not that anything's wrong with where I am. You got to really, really dream big. But I think the other thing is, you got to have hope. You got to find something that gives you hope, because when you got hope, man, you will fight through, you'll pick yourself up, because you got hope for a better day, a better time. And the biggest thing I think we can do is help people not feel hopeless. And that's why I speak about my trauma, turning trauma into triumph, because there's nothing worse than a broken person who feels hopeless. And we can't allow people to feel hopeless. And but life is okay. You're going to get through it. We all have a story, and it's up to us to, change the narrative, and don't be afraid to go for it, and just give your best, and that's all you can do, and trust your faith. and be good. Be good people. I always tell folks, put good energy in the air, into the universe. You put good energy into the universe, good energy is going to come back to you. And surround yourself around good, positive people who really want to see the best for you.
Amen, amen. I'm going to ask you a closing question that you and I go back and forth on, but, you know, Howard or Morehouse?
She got to remember, and this is what I tell folks. I came to Morehouse at you know, that right age, you know, 18 to 22.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And when I was at Howard, I had already, you know, I was, you know, well, like I tell my kids, daddy's only so mature. So I was great yeah. time more mature. But I, you know, I was on a mission then. You know, I was focused on my career.
Uh-huh.
Now, Howard, for me, Howard was big, you know, because they had the med school, the law school, the, you know, nurses, all kind of stuff. I mean, it was just huge. You know, Morehouse, Spelman, Clark, I mean, it was just we had our little world. And but they're both great. I mean, it just depends what you want. Like, I love living in D.C. I was a cashier at the Food Depot, Food Giant, right there on 7th Avenue, down the street from the school.
Yep. Well, Trustee Moody, you and I will have this conversation ongoing. As a bison at Morehouse, it's very interesting to me.
You know how much better you've become by being there, but no, they're both great. Listen, Howard and Morehouse are both incredible institutions, along with all the other black institutions, and it's a good rivalry that we all tease each other. But one thing I love about black colleges, there's a fraternity and sorority kind of among people who went to black colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it doesn't matter which one you went to. But we tend to always kind of help each other, flock to each other, because we know what you've been through.
That's right.
And also, there are a lot of times where, you know, our classmates, you know, from our high schools and different stuff act like, you know, we went to a second level kind of school when you went to a black college. And it was amazing over the years how many people didn't go to a HBCU because they were made to feel they were going to a secondary place.
Yeah.
And it's just so unfair and untrue. And there's nothing like it. And both my kids went to black colleges and graduated. My son went to Morehouse. My daughter went to Spelman. And they could have went anywhere they wanted. But they said they heard the stories and they would come to homecomings and stuff. And they just wanted that experience and they're doing well.
That was it. Well, Mr. Moody, thank you so much. We're at time, but this has been a treat, and hearing you share your story again is very, very inspirational. And you left some things with me that I have to also think about as I continue on with my career as well. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today and just sharing some of your story outside of what folks might see in newspaper clippings or at a dinner or a banquet hearing you speak. It's very, very impressive. And I'm so grateful and humbled that you spent some time with us today and our audience. And I thank you so much for doing this for us, sir.
All right. Thank you for having me, and keep doing what you're doing. And I'm really proud of what you're doing, and you're changing lives. So don't stop.
I won't, sir. With folks like you to turn to, I definitely won't. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for our show this week. Thank you for joining us. Next week, we'll have another interesting guest on. I won't say who at this point, but we continue to try to find the guest that will continue to inspire our people and give our young folks something to shoot for. Remember, it's easy, son. Quit making things difficult, or better yet, it's easy, son. Life lessons on the journey to your purpose. Thank you so much, and enjoy your week.